Following is a Dharma talk by Pandit Bhikkhu, who is based in Bangkok and can be found at littlebang.org.
So this is my last night with you all in Hawaii, my last talk, my last job.
For this year.
For the moment, yeah. Are you sitting comfortably? Do you all know who Napoleon Bonaparte was? If you know who Bonaparte was, during the French Revolution, it's hard to imagine now, but Napoleon sent waves of fear throughout Europe. I mean, people were petrified of this man because he was acting in the role of a king and he was an ordinary person. And that just wasn't heard of. So we had a lullaby in England. It goes like this. This is what we would sing to children to help put them to sleep. Baby, baby, naughty baby, hush you squalling thing, I say. Peace this moment, peace or maybe, Bonaparte will come this way. Baby, baby, he's a giant, tall and black as a ruined steeple, and he breakfast, dines, rely on every day on naughty people. Baby, baby, if he hears you as he gallops by the house, limb from limb at once he'll tear you, just as pussy tears a mouse, and he'll beat you, beat you, beat you, and he'll beat you into pap, and he'll eat you, eat you, eat you, every morsel, snap, snap, snap. Now you know why the English are so messed up. Yeah? So I like this, it's one of my favourite poems, this one. It says a lot. And this idea of Bonaparte being the bogeyman, and I actually speculate that this was commissioned because it's so perfectly metered and rhymed. I mean, it is a fantastically written poem. And I suspect that it was commissioned by the King of England to terrorize kids into fearing and hating the French, which is a feeling that continues to this day. To indoctrinate the children, you know, that this man Bonaparte was really shaking Europe. As he was a great man, he was an incredible reformer, not just his battles and his wars. His war fighting was his last resort. He really wasn't a warmonger, he was a reformer. And he wrote the civil code for France, which is basically still used today. But this idea of a bogeyman that's out there to get you, and if you're not careful, this bogeyman is going to come back and get you and beat you, beat you, beat you. It's something that I've come across in meditation, that when we talk about being in the present moment, and we talk about just establishing your mind in the present moment with what's arising right here, right now, and one common objection or question that people have is, well, if I simply worry about what's in the present moment, what about all the stuff in my past? And isn't this a bogeyman that's going to come back and beat me, beat me, beat me? So if feelings come up, feelings of anger, resentment, or things from the past come up, there's this idea that, well, somehow we have to deal with that. We have to deal with our past, otherwise it's really going to come back and beat us. And in meditation, we're doing the opposite. If something comes up from the past, you just note it as a memory and let go. You're establishing your mind firmly in the present moment. So there's no need in the Vipassana model to be worried about stuff that's been going on in the past. Now this seems to be a little bit of a worry with some people, and one of the questions that's often raised is, am I not just repressing the feelings? Am I not just repressing the thoughts? And it may be that you are, but we have to consider it from the point of view of the different models. And we want to be careful not to mix and match models. And what we do have within Buddhism and yoga and psychology and New Age stuff, especially in America, you have this real mishmash of a whole bunch of different models that have come from different places and different traditions. And we're trying to mash them all together into a whole theory. Now, that may be possible, and somebody may attain to it one day. And Jack Kornfield and crew was it a greater path, they call it, or something? The bigger, the greater something, wasn't it? Great way. Yeah. Within this great way, you have a bit of psychology here, you have a bit of Buddhism there, you have a bit of yoga there, and you have a bit of relaxation down there, and a bit of ice cream up here, and you stick it all together, and you've got this grand, great way. They may succeed in doing this, in putting together, something within a homogenized whole. But within my view, when we're picking up and considering a teaching, is to consider where it's come from. And are we taking a teaching from this guy and putting it into someone else's theory? So these different models, just as an example of how models work. Models are theoretical models. They are not real. They're not actual. So even the Buddha, he used all kinds of different models or ways. When I say models, I mean a way to describe you, a way to describe what you are, how you are, this. We have to break it up into pieces and components in order to consider it. If I look at all of you and I say, the group doesn't give us much to go on in terms of describing the group or making a prediction. And this is what a model should do. It should describe something and it should be able to make a prediction from that description. So within this group here, there are male and female. There's one way to divide the group, roughly 50-50 looking around. There are those of us who are young and those of you who aren't. There are those of us who can use computers and those of you who can't. There are those of you who split the world into two kinds of people and those of you who don't. There are tall, short. We can measure people who wear glasses, people who wear thick glasses, thin glasses, no glasses, contact lenses. There are any number of ways. There are those of you, those of us who are English, at the top of the pile. There are those of you who are from other places, anywhere else, basically. Native English speakers, American speakers.
People from the colonies.
Yeah, the colonials, and what was it? Any Australians here? The convicts. So these are different ways that I can model the room, and however I model the room will have different predictions. So if I say, 80% of you do yoga, I'm going to predict that the average body mass index of this group is going to be within a certain realm. And the Buddha, he also used different models to describe this. And we don't want to mix and match even the Buddha's own different models. The models aren't real. We don't want to say there's 10 Thais, 15 Americans, and 4 English people in the room, and then start saying, well, then there's tall people and short people, and then there's people who wear glasses and people who don't. These are all different models that we would be mixing up. And the Buddha himself described his teaching as like a raft. And a raft is something that you stick together from the bits and pieces that you find around in the forest. This is your vehicle. And when they talk about the Hinayana, the lesser vehicle, I think, yeah, that's the raft. That's a lesser vehicle. We don't need a yacht to get across the ocean and get enlightened. Or a hovercraft. Now you're talking, I think. Lesser vehicle, greater vehicle, and diamond vehicle. All vehicles will be towed at the owner's expense. So a raft is stuffed together from the bits and pieces that you find around you, and you tie it up and you use it to get across the water. The raft itself isn't the truth. And this is the way the Buddha himself described his teaching. They're just models. They're just things that you can put together in order to use for the purpose of getting across. So if we take these different models then, if we take something like repression, which is the Bonaparte, this is the thing people seem to be afraid of. If I just keep my mind in the present moment and I don't deal with my stuff from the past, then am I not just repressing it? Now, repression you will not find in any Buddhist suttas. I even know very senior teachers, monk teachers, Buddhist teachers, who I won't name while the recorder is on, who talk about just let feelings come up, you know, don't attach, okay, Buddhism, and don't repress, not Buddhism. This idea of repressing feelings or repressing emotions isn't there in the suttas. Repression is a Freudian psychological model. Now, either one may have validity. I'm not saying that one model, I'm not saying Buddhism has validity and psychology doesn't. If you know me, you know that I quite like psychology and I like bringing in the models from psychology. But I do like to be clear on what's coming from psychology and what's coming from Buddhism. And then it's up to you personally how you want to pick up and use these different tools. So within psychology, Freud had this idea that there are three kinds of anxiety or distress or what we might call dukkha. There is real stress, real anxiety. So if somebody brings a huge snarling dog in here, you're going to feel a bit of fear, and that's a real fear, and that's a justified fear. You'll be sensible to be afraid of this huge snarling dog. You know, if I bring in a snarling house cat, then you're not going to be so frightened. You know, you just give it a kick and it's not going to threaten you. It's not going to threaten you, so you're not going to be so afraid. It's not justified to be afraid of the house cat. So these are real fear if you have an obvious justification for being afraid or having anxiety over something. Moral anxiety, have you done the right thing, have you not done the right thing, was another level of anxiety. And this is how lie detectors work. And actually lie detectors give me a lot of confidence in humanity, because what it means is when you lie, you actually stress out. When you tell the truth, you relax. So this kind of tells me that our natural tendency is towards truthfulness. The lying will increase your galvanic skin response, your heart rates, you know, your eyes, your body language. If you look on YouTube, where that great depository of all information and confirmation of anything, and you see Bill Clinton saying, "I did not have relations with that woman." Well, according to body language, if you're telling a lie, you have disparate gestures. So he's pointing in this direction, but he's nodding in this direction. It's literally like, well, here's the truth and here's what I'm saying. You know, he's splitting it up. So when you tell a lie, you are increasing a moral anxiety. It's one example of moral anxiety. And the third kind of anxiety was neurotic anxiety. And this is when you have a fear on something which is unjustified. There is really no reason for you to be afraid of it. So somebody comes and accuses you of something you didn't do. You really don't need to be afraid of that. You really don't need to defend yourself against that. You know, unless it means you get fired from your job or something, but you know, if somebody criticizes you, you really don't need to have an anxiety arising because of that. Sitting up in front of people as a speaker, you don't need to have anxiety over that either. This is a neurotic anxiety. It's quite natural. And yes, it'll take you a little bit of training to be able to sit up in front of people. But if you've been on stage and you've liked stage, then you know this kind of anxiety. So according to Freud, anxiety will arise. And what you do is you defend yourself against this anxiety. And these are what he called defense mechanisms. He had about 8, but Anna Freud actually expanded it to around 16. And she was really the champion. And if you look up defense mechanisms, I would look up Anna Freud's list, because it's very comprehensive and very interesting. And actually, next time I come, maybe one of the talks I'll do is we'll go through these defense mechanisms. Because you'll find that within that list, all of you do these defense mechanisms from time to time. So there are different things in there, like denial, not just a river in Egypt. This is a way that you defend yourself against anxiety that comes up. It's not true. I don't accept it. And I had that when I told my parents I was going to become a monk. They said, no, you're not. And I said, I am. No, you're not. And then I quit my job. What are you going to do now? I'm going to the monastery. No, you're not. And then I sold up all my stuff. And they said, why have you sold up all your stuff? I was like, because I'm going to the monastery. No, you're not. This went on and on for years and years, because they didn't... Because they didn't like it. And then when I decided to ordain, they saw the vice abbot of the temple, and he said, okay, you know, Pandit's going off to become a monk for 5 years. I said, no, he isn't. And it doesn't stop. This is denial. So this is a good example of one of the defense mechanisms. I won't go through them all here, but there's things like denial and asceticism or isolation when you become flip, or you just decide not to deal with something and you decide you're going to deal with it later. What are some of the others? Sublimation is when you take the pain and you turn it into something artistic and something positive. Regression, when you retreat into childlike behavior, you know, stamp your feet and shake your fists. And I actually had this with a friend of mine who was in hospital. He died, actually. He died of the flu, and it took him 2 months to die. So I would go to the hospital every night while his parents weren't there, because his parents were very strong Catholics. And they hated me being there. And they're really, really antagonistic towards me, and I couldn't figure out why. So I used to go in the middle of the night. He was in the ICU for 8 weeks. I mean, he was really, really bad. It's incredible. Just slowly clawed his way back into consciousness. And then just as he was getting onto solid food again, just as he got out of the ICU, he just died. He had a son born while this was going on, and one kind of thinks that he was hanging on long enough to see his son, and then, you know, he was off. And then, after, his parents had been very antagonistic towards me, but while he was regaining consciousness, he had suddenly had this desperate desire to do meditation. So there's a lesson for you. Don't wait till you're, you know, in the ICU to do this. I'd known him for years, and we were friends through the computer. We were part of the same computer club, and we'd help each other out with programs. It's nothing to do with religion. Why would his parents be worried just because I'm a monk? It didn't make very much sense. Hey, they were French. Maybe that's why it was. And he would tell them, no, I just wanted to do meditation. So he would ask me to come back every night and do meditation with him, which is what we did. But his parents were civil, but very frosty towards me. But I turned up to his funeral, and his father actually chased me away through the car park, shaking his fist at my face, jumping up and down, shouting, red-faced, my son was a Catholic, he was a Catholic. I'm like, so? He was good on the computer, that's why I liked him. So regressing back to childlike behaviors as a way to deal with your anxiety, right? So these are many of the different defense mechanisms, which I didn't want to talk about. The one that I did want to talk about was this idea of repression. And if you repress a feeling within the model that how Freud described it, if you repress a feeling, you don't know it. The whole point with repression is it's something that's buried in your past and you've forgotten about, and you don't know where it comes from, you don't know why this anxiety is there. So you may have a real fear of furry animals or people in hats or something, you know, crazy or not crazy. Where does this fear come from of people in hats? Well, something happened to you in the past that you refused to accept, and you buried it and you can't remember it. So in terms of meditation, if something's coming up and you can see it, you're not repressing it. That's not repression. The whole point of repression is you don't know that it's there. Now, what Freud said was, and you may agree or disagree with Freud, as I've said several times, his theories are very much out of favor at the moment. However, there's still a lot of validity in things that he said, whether you agree or not with his ideas and his means. But what he would try to do would be try to uncover these repressed memories. And then you bring them up in a safe space, and you have a catharsis. So you remember that thing that's happened, and then you know, oh yeah, okay, this thing happened to me in my past, But here I am now with my therapist in a safe space with a safe teacher, and I'm not sure how safe I'd feel with Freud. He was a bit of a he was a bit of a creepy uncle, you know what I mean? And then you have a catharsis, and once you've re-experienced that feeling, then it's not going to cause you anxiety anymore. So in terms of repressing them, when we're doing the Vipassana meditation and something comes up, some feeling comes up, some memory comes up, and we say, well, just let go of it. It's just something that's arising. You don't need to worry about it. Practice the letting go. Often people say, well, am I not just repressing it? You're not repressing it if you've just experienced it. That was the kind of point of Freud's model, that if you can remember something, if you can experience it, if you can hold it there in your mind for a few moments in a safe space and then let go of it, you've no longer got that repressed memory, and that thing is no longer going to cause you anxiety. So, don't be afraid when the thoughts come up and you feel like, am I repressing it or not repressing it by not indulging in this line of thinking? Now, there is one trick that you can do. By the way, defense mechanisms also I've described as something that's a little immature or a little foolish, a little stupid, that we shouldn't need to defend ourselves against anxiety. But within the Freudian model, defense mechanisms are all good things that we should use when we can't deal with the level of anxiety that's right in front of us. Then we employ a defense mechanism to give us time to deal with the subjects, to deal with the pain. And the one example of this is the defense mechanism of isolation, where something traumatic has happened, but you just isolate yourself from it. It's like you ring fence it. And you accept that it's there, you accept that you have to respond to it, but you're not going to accept any of the anxiety that comes from it. And one of the best examples of this was a man, I'm not sure where he was, but he had an accident on a farm. So he's on a farm, that's where he was. And he lost his arm in this farming machine. And so what did he do? Very coolly, brushed himself off. He picked his arm up. He walked around to his neighbor's house. He rang the doorbell and waited. The neighbor came and he said, could you please call me an ambulance? Now, what's he doing? How is he able to isolate himself from that anxiety? This is the defense mechanism of isolation. Mentally, he's saying to himself, I know that this terrible thing has happened, but there's something I've got to do. Therefore, I'm just going to get on with what I have to do, and I'll deal with the trauma later. Of course, you do this subconsciously, but this is an example of a defense mechanism working as it's supposed to do. And of course, later on, he's going to be traumatized, and he will have to deal with the trauma of putting his arm back on. I actually know a really sick joke about this. Should I? Should I? That's why I do it. That's why I say it. And then I can't go back. You know, I've cornered myself into saying it. There's a man who lost all his fingers in an accident. And so he went to hospital and they say, well, did you bring your fingers? Because we can sew them back on now. And he said, well, I couldn't pick them up. Okay, so defense mechanisms are something. So sometimes you do repress things, but in order to deal with them later. And so, and I call this suppression rather than repression. You're blotting something out for the moment. How do you know if you're blotting something out? And I have this story which demonstrates very clearly when you're trying to physically or mentally blot something out because you don't want to deal with it. And this was my brother's girlfriend. And I'm very happy to be able to tell you all that I'm pretty good working with cars and my brother wasn't. So I was rather pleased and rather proud when his girlfriend rang me up and said, she was borrowing his car and she was driving down the road and it had started making a huge rattling noise like a tank and shaking about. So I jump into my car and I put my toolbox in and I go driving off down the road to where she is. It's not very far away. She doesn't know what the problem is, right? Because she doesn't know about cars. But I could tell what the problem was with this car when I was still half a mile away from it. Because I could see the car half a mile down the road and I could already tell what was wrong with it. The back wheel had come off. I couldn't make this up, right? The back wheel was at a 45 degree angle on the back of the car. And when I got there, there was one wheel nut left remaining, holding the wheel on. And I said to her, look, I've had wheels come off before. I've forgotten to tighten up the wheel nuts. And what happens is you go driving along and the wheel starts to go bang, 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 and it starts to shake. And then you go, holy bleep. And then you stop and you get out of the car and there's still five wheel nuts on it and the wheel's still like this. But, you know, because you can tell. And I said, didn't you hear the rattling? Didn't you hear it, like, making this noise? And what she said is absolutely true. I'm not making this up. I said, she said, yes. I said, so what did you do? And she said, I turned the radio up. Now, I'm honestly not making that up. I'm not dramatizing this story. This is verbatim how it happened. So this is my example. When you're really suppressing something, you cover it up with a noise that's even louder. So if there's something that you can't deal with and you say, no, 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 and then you just launch yourself into something else, usually quite manically, quite aggressively, going to start doing something else, that's when you're covering something up. And there's a few years ago, there was a politician in Singapore, and I think he was head of like the sports or the national health or something like that, something to do with health. And he was in perfect physical form, and he went to the doctor, and they told him he had something quite nasty wrong with him, and I can't remember what it was. But his response was, every day he would run 1 mile on his running machine. So his response was he went back and he would run 5 miles a day on his running machine. And this is covering up the fact that he's been told he's got this sickness, whatever it was, but he's just covering up with a manic activity, you know, by launching himself aggressively into doing something different to try and, you know, deny or blot out that anxiety that's been caused. And he himself talked about this in the newspapers, and he was giving his own example as a warning to other people, you know, if the doctor tells you there's something wrong with you, even if you feel fine, you know, you'd better go and have it sorted out. So that's repression, and that's how repression works in Freudian psychology. It's something that you have repressed that you don't know about. It's a forgotten memory that's causing you anxiety now. Suppression would be trying to just blot something out by covering it up with something that's noisier and louder. Within Buddhism, we don't have either of these ideas. We don't have either of these ideas. The Buddhist model is one of the gatekeeper. And mindfulness was said to be like a gatekeeper in a city. And the gatekeeper's job is to let good people into the city and keep out the riffraff. Rather like a bouncer, right? And so the gatekeeper doesn't have to worry about what's in the city or whether the city works or not, or ruling the city. What happens when these people go into the city, and do they pay their taxes, and do they, you know, steal stuff, or are they decent traders, are they honest? That's not the gatekeeper's job. The gatekeeper simply stands on the gate, and if somebody looks worthy and respectable, they're allowed in, and if they don't look worthy and respectable, they're kept out. And this was the Buddha's own analogy for the function of mindfulness. That right in the present moment is the gatekeeper. You don't need to worry about what's in the soul, what's in the heart, all this stuff in your past and repressed stuff and suppressed feelings and things that your mother did to you and the things that happened to you in school, that's all the stuff that goes on in the city. You only need to stand on the gate, and the gate is the present moment. So when you see something coming up in the present moment, you make a judgment call. If you've got mindfulness, is this quality worthy of developing or not? That's your only decision that you need to make. If it's not worthy of developing that quality, what do you do with it? You let it go. You give it up. Now, what happens to it when you give it up is not your responsibility. You don't need to worry about that. In the Buddhist model, now, you know, there may be a time or a place when you would want to use the Freudian model. There may be a time or place when you want to use a different psychological model. You know, that's okay too. I'm now just talking about the Buddha's model for how mindfulness worked. So just like a bouncer in a nightclub, if somebody comes and, you know, somebody comes and tries to get in and the bouncer doesn't let them in, what do? They go around the corner, they ruffle their hair, they turn their jacket inside out, and they come back with a fake Scottish accent, and they try and get in again. Well, that's going to happen with your unpleasant qualities. You know, when you see an unpleasant quality come up, jealousy, anger, hatred, delusion, and all the rest of it, yes, it's going to go away and it's going to disguise itself again and it's going to come back. But the gatekeeper doesn't have to go running after them. It doesn't have to jump on them and beat them up and kill them. The gatekeeper only needs to stand right on the present moment, right on that gate. And then bit by bit, you get this confidence that anything it is that comes up, you can put space around it and it's not going to overpower you. You get this confidence that, you know, the unwholesome qualities and oftentimes the anxiety, you can actually deal with it without letting it overpower you. Now, if it is a really unpleasant quality and you're willing to look at it, you naturally arouse this tendency to get rid of it. So an analogy that I've given a few times in the last week is of a dead dog, of a person. I should start at the beginning of the analogy, shouldn't I? A person who is a young man or a young woman who is very fond of their appearance and is dressed very nicely and is fond of their appearance and position in society. If you were to drape a dead dog around their shoulders, how would they react to that dead dog? They would react with disgust and immediately, without any hesitation, would attempt to throw that dead dog off their shoulders. In the same way, when an unwholesome quality arises and you've got mindfulness and you're willing to see it, the wisdom arises immediately, I want to get rid of this unwholesome quality. Now, this is no repression going on here, you see, in this model. There's no like, well, let the dead dog be there and try to get used to it and just ignore the smell. And, you know, people won't judge you. And if they do, just let go of that. No, it's like, this is an unwholesome, unpleasant quality. Throw it off. The word in the suttas was bahana, which means to eliminate, to destroy. If you're a Doctor Who fan, it means exterminate. You know, it's quite a strong word. This isn't, a gentle word. The Buddha was very Indian, you know. He's very strong and very tough and very harsh in very many instances. Somebody would have a wrong view and he would kind of tell them, you have this pernicious and evil view, and on account of this you're going to be cast into a state of woe for many a lifetime. I mean, he would be really hard with people. So this word pahana is to get rid of it. I use the word abandon. It's a little bit nicer, a little bit kind of middle of the road. But even so, abandon is very clear. You throw that quality off. So this is just with something that's arising in the present moment. And this means you don't have to go back and sort out my psychological problems. So something like my childhood, not mine personally, but, you know, one's childhood. Usually there's a lot of, like, stinky, horrible stuff in there, you know, and if you choose to dwell on it, you can really get caught up in all this stuff that happened to you when you were younger. You know, my mother didn't like me, and my father was never there, and the kids beat me in school, and all this kind of stuff. So what do you do? You've now got a choice. If you're worried about repressing it, you can just hold it in your mind and think about it and go over it and over it and over it. Script it time and time again. Do you know what you're doing when you're scripting these kind of thoughts? My childhood, or this time when I got fired, or when I failed, or when I did something wrong, or I didn't do something wrong, but I was blamed for it anyway. All this kind of stuff. Do you know what you're doing when you're scripting it? You're trying to retell the story so it has a happy ending. So you're not afraid of that story anymore. But I have to say, you're not very good at it, if you're anything like me. You keep going over and over and over, and it still ends up with that unhappy ending again. This is what we're doing when we're scripting. So there's something, you know, the thought comes up, my childhood. You need to be very clear. This is not my childhood that's in front of me now. This is me now conjuring up a particular feeling. And if I give attention and attachment to that feeling, I'm going to encourage it to come up again. The more often you give attention and intention to a particular thought or feeling, the more often that feeling is going to come back up. Even psychology has come around to this method. Freud had a different view, and this is one of the many areas where we consider him wrong. He had the view his analogy was of the, you know, the cutting edge technology of the time, which was a steam engine. And he had this idea that, well, you can go along and pretend to be very nice, but you have this inner anger and it bubbles up and it boils and it boils and boils and it builds up steam and pressure until sooner or later it explodes. And that was his model. So one of the ways that people who used to follow this model would try to deal with anxiety is like scream cushions. You know, scream into a cushion, yell at your husband who's not in the room, but you yell at him in the pillow and the cushion and maybe beat him and stomp him a little bit. And then you've worked out your aggression towards your husband. And then you go back and you're just nice to him again. Well, it doesn't work. And very few schools of psychology still actually believe that this kind of therapy works. Because what you're doing is you're increasing that tendency towards anger to your husband. Because you're giving it attention, you're giving it intention, and you're deliberately calling it up. My childhood, you know, I shouldn't have happened, they didn't like me, and blah, 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 and I didn't have any parents, or they moved me around. Tragic things, you know, I don't want to belittle people's past and history. And there may be certain times and situations where you should use psychology. I mean, as a working psychologist, and if you have children, or something that have come from abused homes or something like that, then you need to use the appropriate psychological models to help the children. But in that instance, you wouldn't be telling the children, you know, just be mindful and, you know, don't worry about it, just whatever's coming up in the present. You wouldn't do that with the children, right? So, you see, the right model is to be used in the right circumstance, in the right time. So if I dwell on my childhood and like, oh, it wasn't right and I didn't like it and, you know, my house was so unhappy, and what I'm doing is I'm increasing the tendency for those thoughts to come back again. I'm increasing that tendency towards the feeling of depression to come up again. If, on the other hand, I'm mindful and I'm looking at this as a quality of mind in which I'm training myself by encouraging it, do I really want to depress myself with calling up all this stuff from the past? No, I can see it as the dead dog. I can see it. This quality is something that's making me unhappy. And why do I want to keep calling it back? So I throw it off, the bahana, I abandon it. Just now in the present moment. Doesn't mean it's never going to come back again. Okay, I haven't gone back into the past and erased it from my memory. But just in the present moment, for one little thing, for one little moment, I've seen these thoughts come in. I'm like, nah, I'm not going to follow that particular line of thinking. That then, for me personally, who was really upset about their childhood and had an unhappy past and suffered for many years from depression, this to me was just like the most beautiful, perfect teaching I'd ever come across. Because I didn't have to fix all that stuff, all that horrible stuff in my past. I didn't have to fix it anymore. And if you can see it cease in the mind, you see this come up and you're like, no, I'm not going to engage with that. And then you see it disappear. Now I have confidence that whenever it comes back again, it doesn't have to overpower me. Sometimes it will. Sometimes I get caught up in those trains of thought again. Worry is another one. Even sickness, even dying. People who work with in the hospices and the dying people, even in those extreme situations, you can still see the thoughts coming up and overpowering you, the worry and the fear. And you can see them come up, but if you see them cease as well, they're not going to have so much power over you. And this gave me confidence that I can practice with anything. I may not be able to practice well. I may still visibly flap around and faint and do all the things that I usually do in hospitals, you know, while I'm waiting for the doctor. But even while all that's going on, I still have this mindfulness that's always there. It's always ticking along. It's always working. And I get this confidence that even if the body and even if the mind does get into panic, does get into anxiety, there's always a refuge from it. Sooner or later it ceases, even if the situation doesn't change. Even if I really am going to die in a week or a month or a year, even if that situation isn't going to change, the feeling is not going to overpower me because I've seen it cease. And you only need to deal with something in the present moment. If you try and deal with the past or the future like that, you're going to fail. You can't. There's too much. Too much stuff to go back over. There's too much future. With your future, you're going to get old, hopefully. That's the best scenario. And sick and die. That's as good as it gets. So so we learn to deal with these mechanisms. Now, think about it. If you indulge these feelings, if you indulge these thoughts, what are you going to do? You're just going to think about it. You're going to script it more and more. You're going to compound your suffering over something more and more. And does anybody really wisely, in wisdom, in reflection, does anybody really want to increase their suffering? If you're not English. When you look at it as dukkha, as suffering, you see quite clearly, I don't want to compound it. I don't want to make it any worse. Don't worry about dealing with the big issue. You just deal with one little tiny feeling, one little tiny thought that's coming up in the present. When you catch it in the present moment, before it's compounded, before it's become the old lady who swallowed a fly, I don't know why she swallowed the fly and perhaps she'll die, and she swallowed the spider to catch the fly and swallowed the bird. How absurd to catch the spider that wriggled and wiggled. Swallowed the cat, fancy that, to catch the bird, to catch the spider. This is, you know, the song has a meaning, and the meaning is something very small. You swallow the fly, it's not so bad. Maybe you'll die, but probably not. But you swallow a cat, you're going to die. Right? So the same when you see these things arising in the present moment, it's not a matter of repressing it or not repressing it or allowing it to be there. It's you see it be there, and you see it with wisdom. Do I want to follow this or do I not? So the teaching actually was quite simple. If it's an unwholesome quality that's arising, you abandon it. For unwholesome qualities that have not arisen, you make a determination to prevent them. For a wholesome quality that has arisen, you strive to maintain it, which is why we do loving kindness meditation, etc. Or a wholesome quality that has not yet arisen, you strive to arouse it. This is quite clear teaching. This is right effort, part of the Eightfold Path. Ajahn Chah put it quite nicely, just to finish off. He said, two men who have chickens, this is bearing in mind where he comes from, you know, from the rural area of Isan in northeast Thailand. He said, two men have chickens. One man goes out every day, collects the eggs, he brings them into his house. And his house is great. The other man goes out and he collects the chicken shit and he brings that into his house. He said, and his house stinks. This was Ajahn Chah's description of this particular thing. When something arises, if it's wholesome, you bring it in. If it's not wholesome, you don't have to bring it in. Don't worry about repressing things. Don't worry about suppressing things. It's going to come back in the future. Well, that's something that you see in the future. You get into this knack of seeing things only in the present moment. Now, it's not my past that's arising again. It's me now that's recalling it. It's not my future that's going to come and hit me like a steam train You know, it's me now worrying about it. And I can deal with my worry here now, even if I can't deal with the future. So, as the as qualities wholesome and unwholesome arise then, if you're practicing mindfulness, you put space around them. You have this space of mindfulness because you always have this refuge of the breathing. You have this refuge of good qualities, of mindfulness, of wakefulness, of loving kindness. Is it for me? So it's helpful to finish off with a last story. It's helpful to approach these things with a smile, with a little bit of recognition of, oh, this is me here now, and here I am doing these things again. And you do it kind of with a smile on your face. And if you have a smile on your face, a little bit of a smile, this helps to change your attitude. Now, a week ago I told this story of the a test that they have done in psychology, where they gave a short story to two groups of students. Each group of students is told to read the story and then mark how funny the story is from 1 to 10. 10, very funny, 1, not funny. The average, about 6. Then, that was the control group. Then the next group was told to read the story, same situation, students from the same place, told to read the story, but this time they were told to read the story while they had a pen in their lips. Then the third group was told to read the story while they had a pen in their teeth. Okay. Of the last two groups, which group marked the story as more funny? Those of you who were with me last week, no spoilers. Which group said the story was funny? It's the same story. Which group said it was funnier? Any idea?
Of the last two.
Okay, of the last two, which one said it was funnier?
Teeth.
In the lips, teeth. Why the teeth?
Because you're smiling.
Because you're smiling. Yeah, like that. Or like that. Actually putting, just having that smile on, even if you're not smiling, just putting the mouth into that posture changes the approach that you have to your daily experience. And this is why, if you're getting older, as some of us are, my bit of advice, bit of Dhamma talk advice, don't have Botox in your laughter lines. Because they've done the same experiment on people who have Botox, and it turns out that they also can't smile. So they also, when they're asked to view things, they will consistently view things as less amusing or less funny than people who haven't had Botox. Yeah. It's called a biofeedback, but there's another name for it. It wasn't the vestibular sense. The I can't remember the name for it. Kinesthetic biofeedback. So physical feelings feeding back into the mental attitude. And another example of this is psychologists who, if they have a mental patient who's really in absolute anxiety and thrashing around and in total panic attack, and an athlete who has pushed their body too far and their body have gone into seizures, are actually given the same drug. I can't remember the name of the drug. But the drug is basically will relax all your muscles almost instantly. And it's the same drug. And what happens with the mental patients is if all the muscles are relaxed, the mind presumes that it's happy. The mind presumes that it's in a relaxed situation. So this is the kinesthetic biofeedback. But there is an update to this story with the pen. Recently I told this story, but I didn't have a pen handy. And I had to borrow the pen off somebody. And at the end of the talk, this somebody said, "Can I have my pen back?" And I put the pen down like that. And you know what she said to me? I'm not kidding. She said, out loud, "Don't worry, I've got some antiseptic wipes." You note the plural as well. It's going to take more than one wipe to get this pen clean. Okay, so Don't worry about repressing things. This idea of repression, repressing things, it doesn't exist in the Buddhist model. When we're practicing mindfulness, you don't need to worry about repressing things. If, for some reason, you wanted to use the Freudian model and defense mechanisms, well, I think it's a very useful model to pick up and consider and use. There's a lot of wisdom in there. And I do a talk on defense mechanisms, which is, I think, very interesting and relevant to the way that we deal with dukkha or anxiety. However, we need to be clear that, you know, we don't want to take Freudian psychology and try and insert it into Dharma. We want to take each model in its own right and see the way that it works on its own. So I'm going to leave it there, and that's the end of the end talk. If anybody has any particular questions or comments, we have a short period of time. Anything to add, Terry?
Stop picking up. I have a story, if you will.
Yeah, good. Good.
I was training as a family therapist, and one thing you learn as a therapist is that if you haven't dealt with your own issues, you can't be there for somebody else's issues.
Right.
So I haven't dealt with my child. I hadn't dealt in depth with my childhood. Okay. And so doing that with a grief specialist, I was able to be, I would go home at night and journal and cry. And it was absolutely wonderful. The more I released the tears, the happier I became. And then because I could be with my own grief, I then chose to, I wanted to do hospice work. And so I went to this 4-day retreat back in 1989 with Stephen Levine, who I had no idea who he was. And it turns out we were meditating, doing mindfulness for like three and a half hours a day for those 4 days, and I've been practicing ever since. So I found that it was just wonderful to allow the feelings to arise and just be with them. This is before I even knew about mindfulness. And so it was very beneficial.
Yeah. All of these models had a use. You know, they weren't, made up. So if you use it in the right place and in the right circumstance, I also agree. And I've done similar kind of stuff with myself. Yeah, these psychological models, I personally think are very useful. But I think we need to be clear when we're doing, you know, when we're using a model from Freud, and when we're using a model from the Buddha. And even the Buddha, he had several different models that he would use in different circumstances. So all of these things can be very useful. The main line of psychology in the present moment, cognitive behavioral therapy, is that the more often you call up a feeling, the stronger you ingrain the tendency towards that feeling. But if you're doing it with a therapist or with somebody who's trained, you're calling up a feeling, putting it into a safe space, and putting space around it, so then when that feeling comes back up, it's going to have less power over you. So all of these things are good. They can be used in the right way. Why not? Yeah.
Well, is there a certain time of the day that's good to meditate? It seems like...
Yeah, all day.
It seems like it's the evening because people are busy in the morning and, dinner or something in a certain period. I'm not sure if that's a natural time.
Whenever the...
I guess you have the option to do it when you want. When would you do it?
Yeah, I have a set time that I try to do. But I also do it when I like it. And it's important to do both. Always do some meditation every day, whether you like it or not, because then you get to see the qualities of mind that aren't meditative. But then, over and above that base minimum, the times when you're enjoying it, really do it more. And in the last 6 or 7 years, I've started to really enjoy meditation. It was always a burden for me. It was always something I made myself do, and I was willing to force myself, but I didn't enjoy it. I'm honest. So it's much later when I really started to enjoy it. So now I meditate a lot when I'm really enjoying it.
not only do I think that there's a place for psychological tools, but I think a lack of a psychological piece is a real impediment to practicing in everyday life. If I came to this practice when I was 20,
right,
and I know that it wasn't an unpleasant, I don't think I'd be this advanced stage of my I don't. Too many people that through years of practice have never seemed to come to grips with the delusional aspects of their own psychology. So I encourage whether it's Freud, Adler, Jung, or whatever, encourage that dimension side by side with it and not confusing practice with it. And I think you're basically saying that, but I want to put in a little pitch for psychological. It's essential, not as a nice thing.
I do think so too. I often get into trouble. People that tell me you shouldn't put psychology in Dharma talks, and then there's a bunch of other people that really like it. People who come from psychology or social services and medical services. So you know, you can please some of the people some of the time. But I would agree with you. And one argument is that psychology has grown up to deal with the Western mind, to deal with some of the problems in the Western mind. And Dhamma was something that was given by someone enlightened. He doesn't have any of these psychological problems anymore. He's enlightened. And he was quite single-minded, like nothing else matters, just come and get enlightened. But he also said that some people have a lot of dust in their eye and some people have little. Some lotuses are beneath the water, some lotuses are above. So how do you help people? Lotus is still, you know, really buried deep down, as most of us seem to be. It may well be psychology. I've also noticed that some people in temples have had psychological problems, including monks, and they tend to get put in a mental hospital. I've seen that a few times, because the temple wasn't able to deal with it. So I would also agree with that. But like you say too, I do think we need to be clear on what we're using and what we're doing. And mixing and matching, I mean, like, ego doesn't exist in Buddhism either. That's, ego came up 100 years ago, basically. And then we get this idea in Buddhism there's no self. Well, that means there's no ego. Well, I have an ego, so I have to destroy my ego. And that wasn't the teaching. So all some of these terms and things get confused and get mixed up and matched up. Yeah, you find ways to conjure up those the wholesome qualities. And I had a boss when I used to sell vacuum cleaners. And this is in England, and you know, we English are a little different to Americans, and it was an American firm. And so there's this American guy, and you know, you ask an American, like in Thailand when they're learning English, and you have the question, how are you? They always answer, I'm fine, thanks. Because they think that's the correct response. He's like, no, we're asking like how you are. You know, are you good, are you bad? And then I say, well, if you're American, you're always great. But if you're English, you're like, no worse, could be better. So this American, he was the head of the sales team, so obviously he was enthusiastic. And he would, and he would not allow you to be in a bad mood. And, you know, it's early in the morning. It's like this job went on all day long. It was all morning, all afternoon, and all night, the job. It was just ridiculous. And then you weren't allowed to be unhappy around him. So when you see him coming down, there's like a little code word that got passed around. You see him coming down, you go, oh, boy, do I feel good. And then you have to say, oh, boy, do I feel good. Oh, boy, do I feel good. Oh, boy, do I feel good. And then he comes around, I'm great. And this is very tiring for English people to do this. And one day I was like, oh, boy, you know what? I don't feel good. And he came up and I was like, no, I don't feel good. And so he stopped and he looked at me and I'm like, well, I'm not going to give in. I don't feel good today. And he said, oh, you poor guy. He said, you don't feel very good, do you? No, I don't, actually. And then he took out a wadge of money. I peeled a few notes off and he stuffed it in my pocket. He said, "How do you feel now?" I said, "Look, I can't always be in a good mood." And he, "Bip, bip." So he peeled off a few more notes and he put it in the other pocket. I said, "How do you feel now?" And I said, "Well, I'm feeling a bit better now." So he took the rest of the money and he stuffed it in the pocket as well. He said, "Now how do you feel?" I said, "I feel great." And he said, "Right, go and earn it." So you can manufacture good feelings if you really try, you know.
Especially with money.
So it's been nice being here with you in Hawaii. I'm not sure when I'll be back. Should be at least a year before I come back. Yeah, and if you're passing through Bangkok, come and see me. I have a website, Little Bang. So if I can finish off with the blessing.